This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And the fact that Yaakov, by intimating that whoever stole the idols of Lavan would die, actually indirectly caused the death of, or premature death of Rachel. And today we have another dimension of violent speech, and that's in the speech of Yaakov as he defends himself against Lavan. Lavan finally catches up with him, as you know, checks out, tries to search for the idols, doesn't find them, and then Yaakov gets angry at him. And we're told by Yichar li Yaakov, by Yorev Belovan. Yaakov got furious, he got really angry, and he argued, he challenged Lavan. And one would expect to find now, remember, Yaakov's a powerful man, he's a strong man, he's Yaakov. And the Torah introduces this next scene by saying he's angry, and he argues. What is the argument, and how does the anger manifest itself? By Yomel Lavan, and he tells Lavan, if you can imagine the scene, he's now, Lavan searched his whole house. His place is upside down, everything's empty, all the closets have been emptied and turned over, and he's been looking. You can imagine what a mess it is, you can imagine how angry he is, and he's found nothing, absolutely nothing. So you can, and Yaakov is, we're told by the Torah, he's angry, he's furious. What did he do to Lavan? Ma pishi, he says, what have I sinned? Ma chatosi, what have I done wrong to you? Ki dolakra acharai, that you come pursuing after me. Ki moshashtos kol kelai, you've searched through all my belongings. Mama tosumi kol kleve secha, what have you found that belongs to you? Just put it on the table, let's see. For 20 years I worked for you. I took care of your sheep and your cattle, and nothing was ever missing. The rams of your flock I never ate myself. I never brought a sick animal to you. I've never taken anything from you. Genuvti yom ugenuvti laila, I worked day and I worked night. You never suffered any kind of a loss through me. I've been completely honest in the way I worked for you for 20 years. Hayisi vayoyim machaloni chorev, in the daytime as I work I was sometimes afflicted by the dry heat of the desert, the kerach baloilo, and of ice and freezing cold at night. Batidar shonosi meonai, I went without sleep all the time that I was working for you. Get an idea of how this man worked. You know, now people think that it's a mitzvah to take as much time away from your boss so that you can do some learning, because learning is supposed to be more important than working for your boss. Yaakov didn't take time from his boss. He was being paid, he figured he was being paid to do the best job he could. If he wanted to learn, that he learned. He'd been in yeshiva, he'd been in Shein Veiva, and I'm sure that he found whatever odd moments he could to learn here as well. But Atidat Shnosi Me'ana, I had no sleep. For 20 years I worked for you day and night. I gave you of my best. Zeli Yisrim Shonobu Visechos, 20 years I've lived in your house. And this is his anger. Where do we see anger? We see pleading, we see humility. Where do we see anger? 14 years I worked for your two daughters. 6 years I worked for your flock. And that's a Chalefes Matkusi Eseres Monim. You denied me of my wages 10 times in different ways. Lulei Elokei Ovi Elokei Avram Ufachad Yitzchok, if it were not for the God of my father, the God of Avram and of Yitzchok, that were it not that they were there in support of me, Ki Ato Reikom Shilachtoni, I would have left here empty handed. The only reason I've got anything at all is because God was on my side. It's not because you did anything. You tried to do me out of whatever you could. You tried to do me out of every little bit of money that you could, even after the way I've worked for you for 20 years. The only reason I've got anything is because of God. Es onyi ve'es yegia kapai, literally translated as my poverty and the toil of my hands. Ro Elokim, God saw, vayoychach omesh, and last night he warned you. God appeared to Lavan the night before and warned him to keep his hands off Yaakov. Lavan was going to kill Yaakov. God intervenes and says, don't touch him. And Yaakov says, it's because God saw my poverty and my toil. And the way we understand that is the combination of the poverty and toil, that he never used his poverty as a reason to take anything that wasn't his. He toiled and he worked even in his poverty for everything that he got, and God appreciated that and valued that, and that's why God intervened. Which is an interesting aside, the Medrash says on this last verse, Rabbi Yirmiyah says, "Chavivo hi hamelocha mischus ovos." Work is more valuable, is more loved than schus ovos. Schus ovos is yichus. Schus ovos works because schus ovos is an accumulated positive bank balance that develops over years, over generations. That's schus ovos. That's the same as a family can accumulate wealth, and generation after generation they can pass it on and continue the accumulation process. So a family can accumulate moral zchus, moral rights, moral its investment in morality and in Torah is something that stays with the family, and each generation that comes after that starts with a positive bank balance, a positive moral bank balance, and it can build or it can deplete that bank balance. That we inherit all investments that our parents make. If our parents have invested in money, we inherit the money if it's there at the time of their death. If our parents have invested in morality, we inherit that morality, just as we inherit their qualities through our genes, so we inherit their spiritual power to some degree through what they've invested. That's chus ovis. That says the Medrash that work is more valuable to God than chus ovis. And where does it prove it? From this verse. What does he say? If it weren't for the God of my fathers, Avram and Yitzchak, I would have no money. But if it weren't for the fact that God saw the way I worked honestly, I would be dead. So when it came to saving his money, what did God use? What schus did God use? Why did God intervene miraculously to make him wealthy? Schus obvious, because you're the grandchild of Avram and Yitzchak. I'm not going to let you go in poverty, being done out by a man like Lavan. You know, I owe your father something, I owe your grandfather something, here's some help. But when it came to saving your life, that's your own merit. And what particular merit? The fact that he was a tzaddik? No. The fact that he davened Shachris, Mincha, and Maariv every day? No. The fact that he learned Torah for 20 years day and night before he came to Lavan? No. What saved his life? The fact that he was honest in business. That's what saved his life. That's what God looked at. That doesn't mean that all the other things aren't important. Of course they're all important, but it just gives an indication of how distorted the way we're teaching and practicing Yiddishkeit today is when it comes to emphasis. What does God look at? There are certain things that God looks at first and foremost and decides whether you're a mensch or not. If you're a mensch, then he looks at the other stuff. The first thing he wants to know, what are the three questions you're asked after one leaves this world? One is, did you fix times for Torah? Did you learn? Did you study? Did you attach yourself to the learning process? Because if you did, then a whole lot of other things that we discussed on Monday night are natural outcomes of that learning process. So the first thing is, did you regularly attach yourself to a learning process? The second thing is, were you honest in business? Nowhere does he ask, did you eat kosher and did you keep Shabbos? That's not one of the questions. Those are things afterwards he has a look at, but what decides whether you're a mensch or not, whether you're even somebody who he wants to deal with or not, is did you learn and were you honest in business? Because that really determines what kind of person you are. Schus ovos, yes. Grandfather, grandfather, bit of money, that's fine. But in terms of saving you, of intervening miraculously to appear in a vision to Lavan in order to save your life, that's because of your own work. That's because of the way you operated in business with Kiddush Hashem, with sanctity, with straightness, with honesty, with incredibly hard work, making a valuable contribution as you go along. God values that. To God, that's critically important. And again, that doesn't suggest for a moment that the other things aren't important. It just suggests how cockeyed we've got in our understanding of what God truly values. That this is fundamental. This is absolutely primary.
Two things. First of all, the same word said by somebody, it could have been said by him in an angry tone, it would change everything. And you probably have more information on that than I do. And the second thing is, you discussed with us a few weeks ago about the sophisticated way that Yaakov did do some manipulation with the sheep. So, you know, we discussed this. So, yes, he was honest, and yet there was something, at the very least, sophisticated and perhaps even a little bit manipulative. So how do you square those?
There was nothing manipulative at all about that. All he did was made a deal. I'll take the spotted sheep. I want something which is clearly definable, clearly measurable, that there'll be no arguments about which are mine and which are yours. So let's talk about the patterns on the sheep. Once he'd established the measure, God intervenes and creates a miraculous multiplication of those, but there was nothing underhand in his deal. His deal is, I need to know which part is mine. And he's talking about sheep. We're going to argue because you're not an honest person, so we have to have some kind of clear demarcation. Did he know that God was going to intervene? No. Then he puts those speckled bark and twigs and things in the troughs of water, so that he's doing something. Because how else, he couldn't genetically engineer, so what can he now do more than work for Lavan? So he makes an effort, as we all have to do in our work, make an effort. God doesn't respond if we don't make an effort. But we need to understand that sometimes there is no logical connection between the effort we make and the outcome. That's one of the most important things to realize in business, that very often you make an effort in area A and the outcome is from area B. There's very, very often no logical connection. But had you not made the effort in area A, B would not have happened. You go running after something and it's because you were running that B hit you. But you weren't running after B, you were running after A and you never come near A.
Why is it that way?
Because God won't help if you don't work, and yet he wants you to know all the time. It's not you, it's him. So if you look at the way your business operates, that's clear every single day. Stop running. There's nothing at all. There's a lovely story I remember. There's a little Darshan, I've forgotten what his name is. Delightful. He used to come around collecting money in South Africa. I'm sure he's been here too. And he used to tell the story that the fishermen tell, and I checked up with fishermen. Apparently, it's true that when the big fish chase the little fish, and they eat them. But when you open up the big fish, you find the little fish in their throats, head down. They should be tail down. He said, because they're chasing the little fish and they catch them from behind. They don't catch them from the front. So, and then they suck them in from behind, so they should be eating them tail down, but they're always head down. And he says, the reason is because they chase the little fish, but they never catch the little fish. The little fish are faster than the big fish. But while they're chasing the little fish, other fish swim right into their mouths. So going in the opposite direction. And if they were never chasing the little fish, then they wouldn't get the big fish. But so you've got to chase. You've got to chase in business. But you've got to realize what you're chasing is not what you're going to get. God has a different cheshbon as to what you're going to get. You might decide what you're after, but God has a different cheshbon as to what you're after. And it's more so with Jews than with Gentiles. We'll discuss that in a moment. And it's not only in business, but business is one of the areas one sees it. So Yaakov has to do something. What can you do? So he takes these little twigs and makes them. He knows there's no scientific relationship between putting speckled twigs in a trough of water and the lamb having spotted babies. He knows there's no logical relationship between them, but he's got to do something, so he does whatever he can do. And God responds. So there was nothing dishonest in that. And as far as Lavan was concerned, it was hard work all the time.
Why work is so important, does it seem like the women in Judaism are encouraged not to work?
Because ideally somebody they're too.
No, it doesn't say have a family, and that's how you become a tzaddik. It says work.
Not a question of becoming a tzaddik or not becoming a tzaddik. It's a question of the honesty with which that work is done, and that the only way that a man can give all that he's got to his employer is if he knows that there's somebody at home giving all she's got to the home. If a man has to be sitting at work worrying about where the children are and while they're watching television or they're on the street, there's no way. And then he's got to do the carpools to get them to their lessons as well and sit and do homework with them and do some chumash with them and prepare them for their next year. Mm-hmm. There's no way he can do that. So there has to be a partnership at home. Now, whether the woman goes out to work and he raises the babies or he goes out to work, unless they're wealthy enough to be able to employ other people to do that, if that's desirable, somebody has to do that, and that's the partnership.
But does she get the same kind
Absolutely
of...
Absolutely she does, if she's a partner in what he's doing. If she's supportive of what he's doing and helping and guiding as they absolutely were, then she gets an absolute 50-50 share of everything that he does, both in learning and in his work, if she's a partner, if she's involved in it. And on the other hand, though, you remember, I think I did a piece of Shulchan Aruch with you at some stage, where the Gemara says that a married woman has to work. Did you know that the Shulchan Aruch's the din is a married woman has to work? Because it's boring and mind diminishing not to work. To be dealing with babies all day long doesn't make one more intelligent, makes one less intelligent. And therefore a woman has to work. But the preference is to be able to work at home, to be able to find a kind of job that doesn't interfere with a child work as well. Me and the Shulchan Aruch, I'm sorry.
Okay. I mean, literally, when you get and the
idea, me and the Shulchan Aruch, and the Rambam, and the Gemara.
It's just untouchable.
You're right. Sorry. You're right. It's clearly, it's Paschal in the Shulchan Aruch. It's like any other law in the Shulchan Aruch. And in fact, haven't I been through that piece of Shulchan Aruch with you yet in the community? And
yeah,
the first thing that you do when you've got money is you hire servants, and the servants do the kind of things that Orthodox women think they're supposed to be doing. That there's some kind of, the only reason a woman has to cook is because there's nobody else to cook. The reason is not because the Torah wants women in the kitchen. The Torah does not want women in the kitchen. It wants someone in the kitchen, and it can't be the man because he's out working, so it has to be the woman unless they've got enough money to hire a cook. But if they've got money to hire a cook, they should hire a cook. Somebody has to look after the babies. It doesn't have to be the woman, the mother. The Torah doesn't want it to be the mother. But it has to be somebody. If there's no money, it has to be the mother. If there is money, hire somebody else to do it. The glorifying of the woman in as the char. Do they call them chars here?
No,
a maid is two, and it's not a maid. I'm talking about a char. To glorify the woman as the char lady is not what the Torah is all about. This is a new thing that we've now glorified the woman as the char lady. And in Eastern Europe, how did it work? The woman went out to work. The grandmother looks after the children.
But wait a minute, you glorify the... Wasn't it in your shir where you glorify... Somebody glorified the...
Doesn't sound like
the, people were fighting... Who were we here this from?
In the what? In the...
In synagogue, people were fighting over...
Who gets to scrub the floor? A long time ago.
Okay, so who gets to scrub the floor in the shul? And that was people would pay to have the job to scrub the floor in the shul. Now how does that differ?
From scrubbing the floor at home.
Yeah.
Firstly, the shul was because it was a base of marriage, was a place of learning. And yes, if a woman does have that job to do, then sure, the way she takes it is in terms of relating to the sanctity of the job and the sanctity of what she's doing. But that's not what she's tasked to do as her primary responsibility. That's not what she's tasked to supervise that. She's tasked to be responsible for that. But that doesn't mean that she has to get on her hands and knees and do it to herself, unless there's nobody else.
So why do these important Balabatim, these great people of the shul, do that?
With the shul,
what's the home?
The home is important too. The home is a place to live in. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, the home is a house. Now what goes on in the home depends on the home. If in the home there's no television, and in the home there's Torah day and night, and in the home there's midas, and in the home there's never a bad word, and in the home there's never an argument, and in the home there's, then yes, scrub the floors, then glorify them, scrub the floors, because the home is as holy as because this is based on Medrash. But if the homes are like our homes, scrubbing the floor, I can think of better things to do. If you've got somebody else to scrub the floor, then rather scrub the floor in the yeshiva or somewhere there, if that's where one wants to do it. If not, our homes are not on that kind of level. That doesn't mean it's not worthy work. Of course it's worthy work. But it's not glorified by the Torah. There's no glory in it. Just as it's not glorified, the going to work that the men do, and that we're talking here about Yaakov, is still a consequence of Adam's sin. So it's also not glorified. But if you have to do it honestly, and honest work is glorified.
But we glorify that Abraham ran, and he got the cow, and he got the tongue, and he served his guests, and he did it himself. Isn't that like a big deal?
Yeah, but he had people helping him. He had people helping him, but you're right, but the service, what did he do himself? Mm-hmm. The service. So what do we do? I used to talk about this in South Africa, where it applies more than here, although it applies a little bit here. The things that the Shulchan Aruch says that a woman should do herself, she delegates. And the things that the Shulchan Aruch says she should delegate, she does herself. What should she do herself? When her husband comes home, she should bring him a drink. She should serve at the table. She should make the beds. There are intimate things that are acts of love and intimacy that are good for a marriage. That's what she should spend her time doing, not waste her time on doing the laundry and scrubbing the floors. Anybody can do that. But serving, having guests at the table and serving them yourself. So to hire somebody else to serve at the table, no, hire somebody else to cook. You serve. And the image is that if you've got servants, as you did have in South Africa, they would serve the table, but the mother had to cook. No, cooking is hard work. Hire somebody else to cook. that serving you do yourself, because serving can't be delegated. You can't, it isn't the same. When you're served by somebody great, that's not the same as being served by a servant. Not the same thing. When you're served by a host, you're served by a hostess. That's a completely different feeling. Service is an interpersonal issue. When in service, you're dealing with people. Dealing with people, don't delegate. Dealing with things, delegate. So cleaning of the floor, delegate. The things that you do for the children, for the babies, that are things, you know what I mean? Changing the nappies, changing the diaper, has got nothing to do with, that's not an interpersonal thing. That's just hygiene and laundry. Sorry? True. If you're doing it, you can insert humanity in it. If you're doing anything, you can insert humanity in it. You can be the garbage cleaner, and you can greet every person on the street. That doesn't mean that the preferred job is garbage cleaning. You can do any job in an elevated way, but there are different kinds of jobs that one can delegate and different ones that one can select. And you should select the ones that have a higher relationship of interpersonal engagement and lesser relationship of working with things. Because that's where there's growth, that's where there's meaning, that's where there's mitzvah, that's where there's chesed, that's where the interaction should be.
If service is so important, how come the men always sit down at the table and they never get up and help?
Because in days gone by, the men used to be very great. Not that the women didn't, but the men were very great, and they were learning, and they were tzaddikim, and there was nothing that a woman wanted more than to have the opportunity to establish that relationship of making him feel that she values his importance and his greatness. And that was incredible for the marriage, and that was incredible for their relationship. It was great for his sense of self-esteem. It was wonderful in every way. And today you'll find that those great men usually get up and serve themselves because they're concerned that their wives are working so hard and so on. But there's a new generation of men who think they're great. And they're the ones who sit. So.
Yeah.
And some are just spoiled. Some of the wives and mothers have just spoiled them. Now, the Medrash says here that on Yaakov's response to Lavan, an interesting statement, says Rabbi Hanina bar Yitzchok, "Kaptenuson shel Ovos v'loy anvetanuson shel Bonim." I would rather be exposed to the anger of the fathers, that's Avram, Yitzchok, and Yaakov, than to the humility of the sons. The son is David HaMelech, King David. "Kaptenuson shel Ovos v'nayim." Where's an example of the anger of the fathers? This one here. Vayichal Yaakov, Vayirav Lavan. Yaakov got angry. What did he say? What have I done wrong? What have I sinned that you've come running after me? Though at Sova, you might have thought of the way the Torah introduces this, Shema Makos, or Ptolem Yusham, that there would be blows there. You would imagine, by the way it's introduced, that there would be some vicious fighting. All we find out is words of reconciliation. I've worked for you so hard, I never did anything wrong. Why are you angry with me? Why are you after me? What is your problem? What is your issue? Let's discuss it. Is that anger? That when it, and the Medrash says in fact that it's normal that if a son-in-law and his family live with a father-in-law and his family, is it possible that after 20 years of living together, if you searched his things, you wouldn't find a teaspoon? You wouldn't find a pencil? Is it possible that you can live together in the same home and after 20 years you won't find one thing that belongs to you? But that's how it was. There wasn't one thing. You say it is possible to find that there isn't one thing that belongs to you.
You can never find anything.
Because somebody else have taken it. Because you're looking in the wrong place. You're looking where you left them. You're looking in your area. But if you went and searched your family's area, you would find lots of things there probably. So he says, is it possible that you're living as one family and at the end the father-in-law searches and finds nothing of his own among his son-in-law's possessions? Nothing, absolutely nothing. Not a pin. That's unbelievable. And yet, look, there's no anger. And what about David? It says, and David was fleeing from Shaul and he met Yonatan. And what did he say to Yonatan? Same kind of thing. Ma sisi, what have I done? Ma veni, what is my sin? Ma chatosi, what is my transgression with my avicha before your father? And then he adds four words. That he seeks to kill me. The mention of murder, the Medrash finds in that a violence that is totally absent from Yaakov. Yaakov has good cause to be angry, talks softly and quietly, and doesn't, and in no way accusing. And in Yaakov's discussion, there's the word of murder. And we discussed in David's discussion, there's a word of murder, and as we discussed last week, the mentioning of a word and the power of that word. But it's more than just the mentioning and the power of that word. the Reb Nosse Tzvi Finkel explains it the following way, and he says, if I say to you, why were you angry at me? I've done nothing. What am I actually saying to you?
You're wrong.
Yes, you're unfair. If I say to you, what are you doing with the sefer? If I say to Karen, what are you doing with the sefer? It's mine. What am I actually saying to her? I'm saying more than that. I'm saying, yeah, I'm saying you're a thief. What I'm saying is you're a thief. It says I'm saying it nicely. But at the end of the day, that's abusive. It would it be abusive to say, you're a thief. You're unfair. You're a crook. There's something, even if that's what I believe, certainly when it's not valid, that's abusive. Abusive doesn't have to be when you're talking to sensitive people, you don't actually have to spell it out. If you imply it, it's already abusive. And when David says to Shaul, well, let's start with Yaakov, why is it even called anger? Where's the argument? This is so conciliatory, where's the argument? Explains it Nosse Tzvi Finkel, the fact that that Yaakov says to Lavan, what did I do wrong, means you're unjust. That's an accusation. That's anger. Yaakov would not have implied that if he wasn't angry. But in the case of David, what is David implying? What have I done wrong? What have I sinned? What's my transgression? That your father is after me to kill me. What is he suggesting? Your father's a murderer. That's what it is. It's not self-defense because I've done nothing wrong. It's not justice. I've done nothing wrong. So if I'm suggesting to Yonatan that I am innocent, yet your father seeks to kill me, what I'm actually saying is your father is a murderer. And that's a violence in David's speech that Chazal criticized. And say, I would rather have the anger of Yaakov where there's no suggestion of anything like that than the mild talk of David, within which is the implication of murder, which is on the Torah scale of violence. I'm not talking about Hollywood scale of violence. Like on a Hollywood scale of violence, this would be rated child talk. This would be 100% clean. In the Torah scale of violence, that statement of David is R-rated. We wouldn't want our children to hear that kind of talk. It's violent, it's angry, and the Gemara says, I wouldn't want to hear it. Hear what? What have I done wrong that you want to kill me? Just that phrase, just that word, the mention of murder and the implication that I'm innocent and therefore you're a murderer is a verbal violence and a verbal abuse that David is criticized for. Now we'll see in a moment, because I do want to still do that, is where it comes from in David, why David talks like that. Linda?
In Bereshit, didn't you say that the phrase Vayochas Emesh, or Emesh was in Hebrew?
Emesh.
A reference to Lavan wanting to kill Yaakov?
Yes.
Isn't that the same thing?
But hardly even a reference. All it's saying is that, look at the words, God saw my hard work, my poverty and my hard work, and intervened last night. That's all he says. I don't know what he did intervene, what he discussed. We know that he saved his life, because we know the story of what happened last night. But Yaakov doesn't, other than by prophecy that God did appear to him. So he said, there's not even this is Yaakov saying, God intervened last night, but what you planned to do, I'm not suggesting you murdered, I don't know what you planned to do. All I know is, whatever it was, God wouldn't allow. We know that God intervened on a murder issue, that God prevented the murder, but he doesn't imply that.
Now, with David and Yonatan, I'm trying to remember the passage, hadn't the text itself just said a few spoken earlier that Shaul got really angry because David didn't show up to the dinner? And if you wanted to kill him.
Yes, we're not saying it's wrong. We're not saying David was making a false accusation.
Well, how can the Gemara be so upset about David's comment, hey, he's out to kill me, when a few lines earlier, Shaul said, I want to kill him, I want the death sentence.
He's not being criticized for falsehood. He's being criticized for being, in the Torah's terms, too blatant. In the choice of words. Oh, he is. Shaul dies for that, and Shaul loses everything for that. Shaul is very much criticized for that. But David is criticized here not for falsehood, just for vulgarity of on his level. Again, we would consider this very, very mild and pure talk. On David's level, there was a certain the violent tone contained a vulgarity that we don't find with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. That's the level of the Torah's consideration of what is vulgar or not. And we sometimes hear children saying things like, when they get angry, like, I'll kill you. That should not be tolerated. Just even the saying of those words, the impact of our words on one another and on ourselves it just dulls one more and more to what's okay and what isn't okay, and to say that isn't okay, even to say those words in jest, in joking, that's just never, never, never okay, not for an adult and not for a child. Liz?
I'm just going back to Judy's question about vocal tone, because the speech that Yaakov gives to Laban, we have no way of knowing his inflections, but I could easily imagine that the entire speech was, well, what have I ever done to you? I did this, 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 I did this. I mean, I could easily imagine saying it in that sense. So how do we know that it really was conciliatory, just based on the words?
That's like the telegram from his son, you know that one? And so in shul in the morning, and he's really angry, and his friend says, what are you so angry about? And I'm going to see this telegram that I got from my son. Do you still know what telegrams are in this country?
Yeah.
Modern day email.
Yeah,
I remember the old days they used to have so they said, so what did your son do? What did he say? Just look at it. He takes out the telegram and says, what's wrong with it? He says, is this for a way a son should speak to a father? Dad, send money. He says, that's not what the telegram says. He says, of course that's what it says. The telegram says, Dad, send money. So I think that's what you're saying, that it's...
extra for the please.
But if you look at it, you can see a little bit from the trumpet, but not much, but it's long-winded, you see. It's not staccato. It's long-winded. Yes, it could have been an angry tone of voice, but we're not talking about the tone. We're talking about the content. He told the whole story, and he goes back. When you're angry, you don't. You don't. Yeah, you don't. See, the Torah must have been trained by you. Why does David have this mentality? And this is where we come on briefly to a discussion on the power of astrological influence. I'm just going to run through this Gemara in English to save a bit of time. Gemara is in the end of Gemara Shabbos, and he says, not the constellation of the day, but that of the hour is the determining influence. So it depends what hour of the day you're born in. Now, it doesn't help knowing what week. You know, like they do in the stars, in the stars column, and then you say that doesn't help you at all. You're not even doesn't help to know what day. You've got to know what hour, and what the formation of the stars were at that particular hour. He was born under the constellation of the sun. Now we don't know what that means exactly, what the constellation of the sun is, but it's at certain times when the sun has certain influence, will be distinguished. He will eat and drink of his own, meaning he'll work and have his own in source of income. And his secrets will lie uncovered. He won't be a secretive person, he'll be an open person. That's the nature of that person. If a thief, he will have no success. He won't be a good liar. So he needs to know if he's born under the sun, he shouldn't try lying. He's too transparent. He's like the sun. It's open, it's bright, it's distinguished, that's how he is. He who is born under Venus will be wealthy and immoral. What is the reason? Because fire was created there in Venus. Venus is a fiery one, there's a lot of passion, and that impacts on his pursuit of wealth and on his morality. He was born under Mercury, will have good memory and be wise, because Mercury is the sun's scribe, whatever that means. So all Kabbalah, we don't understand the details of it. He was born under the moon will be a man to suffer evil, building and demolishing, demolishing and building, eating and drinking that which is not his, and his secrets will remain hidden. The moon doesn't have its own source of light. It lives by the sun, and it's secretive, and it's... So that's how he will be. If a thief, he'll be successful. So if he's a person born under the moon, he can go into dishonest business practices, and he'll get away with it. He was born under Saturn will be a man whose plans will be frustrated. Others say that people's plans against him will be frustrated. He was born under Jupiter will be a right-doing man. Jupiter's called Tzedek, which means from Tzedek. He who is born under Mars will be a shedder of blood. There is a streak of violence in the Mars constellation. And David was born under Mars. And that's referred to often. Very often the people born under Mars are redheads, or they certainly have that kind of makeup. There's a fellow called Professor Sutton. Have you come across him? An interesting man. And from guy who's a professor of psychiatry at UCLA. is doing groundbreaking work in measuring the EKG waves of mentally disturbed people so that they can predict it and so that they can also check the validity and accuracy of certain drug therapies. Because if they can see the mental abnormality in brainwave activity, then they can check what medication it needs, and they can sharpen the form of medication, and interesting work in all that. One of the things that was done, not in his work, and he's been working on this for I think 20 years, one of the work that is the things that have been done was they studied the EKGs of criminals, and they found the same wave patterns in all of them, of violent criminals. So the argument was, of course, that this is a mental abnormality and that there's less culpability, and that it was very convincing work. What he then did was analyze the EKG of non-criminals, and he found that among the non-criminal population there was also a whole large body of people who had that same criminal wavelength. So his conclusion is, based on the Gemara, that yes, you can. The wavelength does not mean criminal. The wavelength means violence. Now, what do you do with that, says the Gemara? Rav Ashi observed, that means you can be a surgeon or a thief, a shochet or a mohel. You can direct that violent trend in constructive and destructive ways. It doesn't mean the thing you're born under is not going to determine your values. It's only going to determine your personality. And that personality is going to lead one, each one of these leads one to different weaknesses, just as it leads one to different strengths. But it doesn't make choices for you. The choices are what we're responsible for. So I'm born violent. Sure, you're born violent, but that doesn't mean you can be a criminal. I'm born with a dishonest streak, but that doesn't mean you have to cheat and lie. There are a whole lot of things that we are born with because of constellations and other influences that we can direct. We cannot change, but we can direct them, and they're important to know. But the important thing that I want to end with is Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Reb Chaim Volozhiner, you'll remember this. The Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, who wrote the Nefesh HaChaim partly in order to, because he was concerned at that time, this was the time that Hasidism was arising, and he was concerned about the popularization of Kabbalah, that mysticism was being popularized in a way that he felt was distorted, and that people were getting the wrong picture. So he wrote the Nefesh HaChaim, which is a very sane, balanced analysis of certain Kabbalistic concepts in ways that ordinary people can understand. And he says the following. This, he says, is a great method, lahaser ulevatel me'alav kol dinim uretzoynes acherim, to annul and remove the influence of all these other powers upon a person, shelo yuchlu lishbot bo, so that they cannot rule over one, velo yasu shum roshim klal, and do no, and have no effect. If a person fixes as part of his mindset and part of the way he functions, Halo Hashem Hu Elokim Ha'amiti, that there is only one true God, Ve'ein Od Milvado Yisbarach, that means there is no power other than God. If we can get that clear in our mind, there is no other power, there is no other force, there is no other influence. Whatever happens is directed by Him. Shum krach ba'olam v'chol alamos. There is no power anywhere in the world or in the universe. Va'kol malei rak achdusu ha'poshut, and everything is filled. The entire universe is filled with the inseparable, and indivisible oneness of God. Umevatel b'libo bitul gomer, and he annuls in his mind completely any other force. Ve'enu mashgiach klal al shum krach v'rotzim ba'olam, and he takes no notice of any other force other than to see trends, but to understand that the force is God's force. And he commits and his mind, the purity of his thinking and his mind, totally to God. God reciprocates. That all these other forces have no power over him. They can have no influence. So we decide whether we want to be under the influence of the stars and various other forces, or we want to be under God's influence. We have that choice. If we choose God, God chooses us. If we choose all the other forces, He leaves us to the other forces. And the Reb Chaim Volozhiner then explains the story in the Torah. You'll remember there was a plague in the desert, and snakes came and were biting them, and God said to Moshe Davin, God said, make a copper snake and put it on a tall pole, And when they look up at the snake, if they get bitten, they won't die. I thought that's a very strange thing, and what does the looking up at the copper snake do, and so on. And he explains with a Kabbalistic concept that what God is saying is, when you look up at the snake and you see the snake is just a piece of copper, but God is the force. Instead of looking down at the snake, when you look down at the snake, what do you see? The snake. And the snake, I've got to be careful of the snake, and your mind is completely dominated by the snake. There's no thought of God. It's all the snake when you're looking down at the snake. When you're looking up and you see the snake in its right perspective up on the pole there, it's just a piece of copper, it's a chemical, it's nothing. It can only do what God allows it to do. The moment you link God to the source of the snake bite, then says God, I'll heal you, don't have to worry anymore, I'll take care of it. And that's the whole process that we have to become accustomed to. Yes, there are all these forces. Because if everything was clearly God, we would have no free will. If every time anything happened, it was obvious that God was pressing all the buttons, we wouldn't have free will. What gives us free will is science. What gives us free will is the predictability of nature, the existence of economic trends, the existence of medicine. These are the things that give us free choice. These are the things that make it possible for us not to believe in God. Now we have a choice. Do you believe in the snake, or do you believe in God? Do you believe in astrology, or do you believe in God? There is a force of astrology, just as snakes can kill. That's not astrology, that's not magic. Snakes can kill. But you can avoid being killed by a snake if one masters, if with your mind you master all these forces. So there is such a thing as astrology, and astrology can impact enormously on our lives. But we can overcome that impact of astrology if we're able to elevate ourselves above that and realize that, see through the astrology, look upwards and see that he who operates all of that is God, then God lifts us up from there. Which is what the Gemara means when it says that God took Avraham out and showed him the stars. This is by Yotzei, Hashem took Avraham outside and showed him the stars and said, your children will be as many as the stars. The Gemara says in that same Gemara in Shabbos, he took him out, meaning he took him out of the forces of astrology and showed him, you can go, you the Jewish people can go beyond astrology. Your children will be like the stars, but go beyond that, look beyond that and see who does that and who's behind it, and with that you can elevate yourself far beyond those forces over which you have no control. You can commit yourself to a force that I control, and that through your relationship with me you can have input into, you can have some control for, and that's the direction that a Jewish life is meant to take. Okay, any questions on that? I can take one or two questions.
Does anybody need to know what
it's good to know past stuff. It's helpful to know what kind of personality traits that causes in me, if I recognize them. So if you read it or you've got somebody reliable that can tell you what kind of a person you are as a result of being born at that particular time of day, and it rings true. When you look at it all makes good sense. It gives you a deeper understanding of who you are, then yes, because then it gives you an idea of what you have to overcome, of what comes naturally to you and what's harder for you. If one then takes that information and uses that in the way one works and the way one prays, then you can overcome the force, and it's useful to know. But if you start getting involved in the future stuff, then you're finished, then you're completely out of it. And that's what we're worried about always with astrology. The trend is to hang on to it for its future stuff. And that's not valid, not for a Jew anyway. Even if it's an accurate astrologist, most of them aren't when it comes to future stuff. But even if they are, it doesn't hold true for a Jew who has the capacity to go beyond that.
But I'm surprised. It sounds like you're saying that King David was affected by it in the way
his passion and his violence. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he was so close to Hashem.
He used his violence against the enemies of God.
So that
went to war, he went to battle. No,
that
was the correct. No, in his term, it wasn't. And all we're saying is not that he was wrong or bad or evil. We were just saying, comparing the two, the violence, there's far more violence in David's statement. And he's saying, and the Medrash is saying, I would rather be protected from that violence. It hurts the ear to even hear such violence. My question is, so where does it come from? David was naturally a violent person. What did he do with that violence? He used it in his battlefields. He used it in war. He built and constructed with that violence. He didn't allow it to destroy him or to destroy other people in the process.